Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Hilaritas podcast. Join me here and now as we explore the vast world of iconic writer, psychedelic psychologist, rebel philosopher, and self-proclaimed agnostic mystic, Robert Anton Wilson. Visit us at hilaritaspress.com/podcast for show notes, links, and past episodes. Right here, right now, it is my great pleasure to share with you my chat with writer and musician, Are You Serious? Ken Goffman, are you or are you not serious?
Mostly yes and no. I guess maybe is exactly the right thing to say in a Bob-oriented podcast.
There you go. Well, welcome to the Hilaritas podcast. You have been, you've had a relationship with Tim Leary, and I wonder what your take on the state of Smile, SMILE is these days, Space Migration Intelligence Increase Life Extension.
Yeah. Space migration does not seem to be something that's about to occur anytime in the near future. It was underfunded and more complicated than was predicted. Intelligence increase, life extension, maybe. It's a complicated political area now. The agenda of what might be called transhumanism, singularitarianism, technotopianism is, I think, correctly associated in most people's minds with billionaires, ruling class people, which sort of early on in the 90s, the early 2000s, you could say, okay, well, that's how things are getting done. But increasingly, these people seem mean. That has an impact on what their intention is and also how people respond to technological hope. So technotopianism was a popular countercultural meme in the 1990s, continued somewhat into the 21st century. It's a radically unpopular view now. There's that contrast that Bob and Tim like to make between neophobia and neophilia, moving towards neophobia with a lot of justification. I don't think that's a good thing either. I think we have to try to resolve problems, and we resolve problems with tools. We don't wait around with our thumbs up our ass, hoping for a miracle. We do things with tools. It's a bad mental state right now for people to be techno-reactionary, but it's also an intelligent political, social observation that the developments around technology don't seem to mean us no good. That's kind of where we are now. I'm always surprised that people are still kind of picking up on the Leary technotopianism stuff. And I reread some of his Future History series recently, and the conclusion I came to was that he was writing one absolutely brilliant science fiction book. And he would admit, I mean, he would call it science fiction. He would admit that these are speculative. It was birthed out of an insane action adventure story under extreme pressure from the system, the policing system, and also from the left. Felt he had sold out or ratted them out. It was really a jewel, a kind of jewel, you know, that came together under a lot of pressure. It's this vision of the future, but is this the future that's happening? I think probably not, but I know, in the Maybe Logic film, I questioned whether Robert Anton Wilson could still be optimistic, and he said, are you serious? He thinks I can't be optimistic because he's not optimistic. but I think, you know, there's perhaps a philosophical opening for a maybe logic thinker who views us on a downward spiral. I could occupy that space for a while. Maybe is maybe. Maybe means maybe something extraordinary will somehow rise up. I don't want to say rise up from the ashes, because the way people look at rising up from the ashes right now involves a lot of loss of human life. I don't want us to rise up from the ashes. I don't want us to accept a lot of an apocalyptic agenda in which some kind of groovy anarchism rises up from a devolved post-neoliberal world. I would much prefer lots of people not to be killed in wars and weather disasters and so forth. So I'm kind of rambling, but
that's great.
The connections make sense in my own mind.
Well, it worked for me. I had a lot of questions come up during that time. Let me see what I can figure out here. Part of what I'm hearing is that there seems to be a general distrust of technology these days.
Absolutely.
Yeah. People, I've been asked what Bob Wilson would think about social media and all this. And certainly he had this idea that internet would lead to maybe logic, but it didn't, it hasn't seemed to pan out that way. Any thoughts?
Well, there's a radical questioning of authority beyond reason. And that's a hard place for the slogan and the hope for the question of authority to be. It's a great quote from Nam June Paik that I've been putting out lately. I'm going to read it. It's not information superhighway. We're in a boat in the ocean, and we don't know where the shore is. So what I think is that when a billion or more people suddenly had access to the internet, we went through a kind of social singularity, the singularity defined by the science fiction writer who just passed recently, Werner Vinge, as a time where we can't know what's happening, we can't know what's next, we can't predict anything. And his singularity, that meant artificial intelligences that are much smarter than us, that may also be happening. But my version of the social singularity is that with a billion people online, nobody can find a sense of self or predict what's about to occur or really get much of a grip on reality at all. But people desperately grab at life rafts and actually tend to be more inclined towards totalistic thinking than they were previous to living in this ocean of information and disinformation and millions and billions of signals, you know, scraping their brains on a daily basis. So, yeah, I think that's the complexity that we're in right now.
And
so I don't know what Bob would have said about that. You know, I think he would have had some interesting thoughts about it. I mean, the idea towards the end of his life, Tim was always saying chaos. He would just say, chaos, man, chaos. And he was like, he thought chaos was a really fecund place, pregnant with possibility. But Kevin Kelly used to say, taking after some people who were working on artificial life, I think at MIT, that life exists or thrives out at the boundary between order and chaos. If we completely lose order, that's not a state for thriving or even remaining corporeal. What is chaos in cyberculture? David Bowie sang in Hallow, Space Boy, this chaos is killing me. I think that was aimed right at Tim, as was Ashes to Ashes many years earlier. But that's a whole other thing. Tim agreed with me, but
Yeah, so that was Chaos in Cyberculture was one of his last books there, and it was a mind bender for me when I read it years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah.
And Bob had it listed as one of his like top 10 recommended books, I believe.
Yeah.
But it sounds like your feeling is that we've swung too far into chaos.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, there's things happen on the boundary between chaos and order.
Right.
I think that's why musically, most people don't really like noise, but they like avant-garde touches that are added to coherent songs. It's kind of like why great Deadheads love it when the Grateful Dead go off in space and then return to something familiar. It's that mix of experimentation and the familiar that satisfies the mind and might be necessary towards having a culture. We promoted High Frontiers and later Reality Hackers and Mondo 2000 as a beribbon letter bomb to the core address of consensus reality. We blew up consensus reality. And what we're finding is that a little bit of consensus can be a pretty good thing. Reality-based politics, something the Democrats like to lean on as opposed to the Trumpians. And of course, they have questionable bragging rights as well. But getting somewhere in the ballpark of reality-based decisions in terms of science, in terms of medicine, in terms of politics, seems to be an important thing. And one of the things we loved about the coming of the internet was that it was going to kind of bust up the monopoly of reality that the mainstream media had. But we also now see that there's some good that comes with trained journalists, investigative intelligence, able to discriminate between absolute bullshit and something with the fingernail grip on what is actually occurring in the world. So again, we're in this very compromised place, I think, when it comes to the Leary Wilson paradigm at the moment.
Yeah, I can relate to all that in that I was just having a discussion the other day with a friend of mine, and we both have teenagers in the kind of later years, like 17 to, well, not teenagers, 17 to 22.
Yeah.
And he was commenting about how so many of them are struggling with mental health.
Yeah.
And I guess in my mind, I thought that they would grow up in this world of uncertainty, and that would just be something they could navigate because they grew up in it. But it seems that our human nervous system needs a little certainty in our lives, a little order.
Yeah. I think that's right. I also think that memetics play a powerful role in people's willingness and even desire to identify with their mental illness. I mean, our generation was like, "No, I'm not crazy." The older generation even more so. "No, I'm normal. Nope, don't tell me." And it's kind of the opposite now. You get out on the internet and you tell people what your diagnosis is, and in some ways, it's a measure of being part of a shared community.
And so say more about that. I guess so the being part of a shared community is something that's lacking, or that we're...
But, yeah, I mean, it's a way of having friendly relations with other people online, is to bring your diagnosis out there as part of your public persona. I mean, it's in a weird sort of way, it's sort of trendy to have a mental illness that you can,
gotcha,
that you can share with the group. I don't want to go too deep into that. I don't want to,
I hear you.
I don't want to underestimate what people are going through.
Oh, I appreciate that. I guess if we circle back, we were talking about space migration and intelligence increase, life extension, and you mentioned billionaire. Well, you mentioned, it seems to me like space migration is maybe the migration part hasn't taken off yet, but there is a profound acceleration of the space part going on.
Yeah.
And again, that's led by the billionaires.
Yeah.
And what I got is that instead of a message of hopefulness, there was a lot of meanness involved.
Yeah. Well, I think the billionaire class, I mean, I have an article on Mindplex, an interview, actually, about something somebody called Tescriel, transhumanism, extropianism, singularitarianism, etc. You can look it up on Mindplex. And there are the person who I interviewed definitely came up with a lot of evidence, a lot of anti-human quotations from ruling class types who are in the singularitarian transhumanism sort of memeplex arena. And that's, of course, so worrisome. I mean, there are two ways to look at transhumanism. I assume this audience knows the basic idea of transhumanism, moving towards the post-human, moving towards a human with some distinctions from ordinary humanness, like longer life spans, cyborgian bodies, I mean, there are various versions of it. But anyway, there are two ideas of transhumanism. One is that it emphasizes the humanism, and it's humanism plus, humanity plus. And the other is that the human isn't enough, that these 80-year-long, 90-year-long, 15-year-long, 20-year-long suffering lives aren't worth it. Maybe we should leave them behind and just go for broke, go for the millions of years of being alive. And there are this incredibly insane interview that I did about Tescrial has ideations of some really influential people in which they talk about how meaningless or how necessary it might be to sacrifice a lot of current human beings because in a future of AI, which would include people living inside cyberspace, inside the matrix, this would involve trillions of lives. There would be trillions of humans living in the virtual space. And it's more important to save those trillions of people than it is to save a few billion, crappy lives here on Earth now. There's always been some very weird ideations going on at the fringes of technotopianism. Some of the people having those ideations and perhaps acting upon them are now in pretty powerful positions of influence.
And so like everything else, there's this split between like a just a massive polarity, humanity plus versus humanity is not enough. And
yeah, I think those coexist in the same person in a lot of places, in a lot of people. It's like if we can make things nice for the masses, we'll do that. But if we can't, we're out of here. Yeah. I mean, I think there was even a little bit of that in Tim, actually.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've seen the term psychedelic transhumanism come around in with you. Is that represent the positive side, would you say, or a little bit of both?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's engaged with both. We've always associated psychedelia with the counterculture, tended to be associated with the radical left, or at least liberalism, to some degree with libertarianism, anarchism. But there's certainly a kind of a hard right-wing faction within psychedelia now, people forming businesses, getting into the business of psychedelia. Peter Thiel is very active in that area. Kevin O'Leary is very active in that area. There's a whole bunch of people who are quite active from a kind of a hard right wing view in psychedelic movement now. What does that mean? I'm not exactly sure. I mean, there's always been this question of also of doing this through the system, and then there's doing it through the system via psychotherapy, and they're doing this through the system via capitalism, and then now they're doing the system via big capitalism, billionaire capitalism, corporate capitalism. And then there's always the So just the libertarian as well as perhaps the left point of view, the authentic libertarian and the left point of view of, you know, let people do what they will with it without the intervention of government, but also of a powerful capital forces, monopolistic forces, and so forth. So, I mean, this is still being played out. You know, I like the idea of people having access to psychedelics under almost any circumstance. I think the potential for abuse probably exists more within what's the word I'm looking for? Psychotherapeutic groups, because that happens a lot in psychotherapeutic groups when they gather into small groups. They tend to become cults, and you throw psychedelic drugs on that fire. I mean, psychedelic drugs have been on that fire in a lot of cults, but in a legitimate way. And there's a tremendous potential for abuse. So we just got to keep an eye on all of it. You know, the world is a complicated messy place.
You can say that again, complicated and messy. I guess there's a part of me that appreciates that capitalism can help accelerate the spread of psychedelics. And there's a fear that it also starts to divorce what I consider to be something sacred and spiritual.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Maria Sabina, who originally had turned Leery onto the mushrooms, as well as a lot of other people, didn't like the commercial of psychedelic drugs in the West, you know, just via culture and via drug dealers and so forth. She thought something was being lost, something of the sacred was being lost in popularization itself. I mean, there are several layers and levels to this. I don't like to steal people's subjective experiences. People have had and will have extraordinary experiences of something that seems like something that's beyond ordinary human capacity, something spiritual, something godlike, something rapturous. People get that from mescaline and LSD and psilocybin. And I don't like stealing that away from them. It's one of the reasons I don't like people trying to credit the entire psychedelic movement to the CIA. I feel like it's stealing something from people who came to it through a psychedelic culture that emphasized vision and openness and spiritual experiences and rapturous experiences. I feel like handing that over entirely to the CIA is kind of an attack on people's subjective wonder.
Well, they did manage to turn Ken Kesey on, so maybe we can thank them for that.
The programs. They definitely had the programs that turned a lot of people on. People make it. It's again a tendency to be totalistic, right? People hear, "Oh yeah, sure, yeah, I helped the CIA." Who was I supposed to help? The KGB? And that's just Leery being Leery. But in these times, you can't say stuff like that or have said stuff like that without it being literalized and spread everywhere. You know, and John Lennon said, we have to thank the CIA for LSD. But he meant he was thanking them. You know,
it's an interesting, you know, people are crediting the CIA and they're discrediting Leary. I believe the author Michael Pollan, who popularized psychedelic therapy with this book, which whose name I forget at the time, but
Changing Our Minds.
Yeah, there you go. And he was interviewing all these various people and, you know, asking what happened. And everybody, he said this was a common answer, that they would say, well, it would be a mistake to blame everything on Timothy Leary.
Right.
And then they would go on to blame everything on Timothy Leary. Having known Tim, what would you say about all that, Tim's role in all this?
He was responding to the time he was in. The youth movement of the late 60s, the vanguard of the youth movement in the late 60s was very radical. And he was rather moderate compared to them, you know, up until the point where the Weathermen broke him out of prison, after which he became a little extreme for a brief period. I think he was just responding to the moment that he was in. But I guess a lot of people blame him going back all the way to Harvard, his getting kicked out of Harvard, and going off on his own to speak publicly about psychedelics. I think psychedelics were popularized by Ken Kesey, by the Beatles, more than by Timothy Leary. And I mean, the Beatles didn't have to say, go take LSD. They just had to release those songs,
right?
You know, and make those videos or whatever. You know, they could be ambiguous about what they were telling people, and, you know, go off and say, "Oh, we're into transcendental meditation now," or whatever. Definitely, rock culture spread psychedelics. Kesey and the Pranksters, Grateful Dead. Leary was less influential in the late 1960s than most of those people. In some ways, he seemed to a lot of freaks like an old guy who was trying really hard to be part of the youth culture. Tim himself said he didn't start really being hip until the 1970s. And trying to be a guru was, you know, was a bit of a sham, a bit of a mistake.
Gotcha. And so something there about just the music really spreading the word. And I think you've written a book, and a lot of what you're about seems to be science, technology, and consciousness. And it's been a belief of mine that technology drives the change in consciousness. I wonder if you could opine a bit on that.
We're in it right now. We're in virtual space, you and I, and whoever ends up watching this will be participating in that. We are absolutely, I think it was the hilarious quasi-cyberpunk author Mark Lehner who said, I can't help but being about pop culture. I'm made of pop culture. And I mean, we are I have more song lyrics lodged in my brain than anything else. And I think many people, you know, have the same influence. So Yeah, whatever technology comes along is going to help to dictate what our consciousness is. And one of the things I liked about the eight circuit theory was how it mapped to technology in the higher circuits, which are on the one hand much more science fictional than the lower circuits, which seemed to almost be almost banal in their accuracy. But the upper circuits, which are much more speculative and difficult to prove or to live in, but they did have this nice technological mapping of the stage five being the wired world, the interconnected global network. Stage six, if I remember mapping well, to biotechnology. Stage seven, I think, to nanotechnology. I think Wilson's switched them around, so caused me some confusion there. I think circuit eight was kind of mapped to quantum reality, and sort of being, in a sense, sort of being lost in that the boat on the ocean that I was quoting from Nam June Paik at Circuit 8. Yeah, I do think that consciousness is largely impacted by technology. And of course, we're very much involved in discussions of psychedelics, and psychedelics are a technology.
Ah, yeah. Excellent way to put that. I
I mean,
think it was.
some of them grow naturally, and some of them come from the chemist lab. But and some people like to make a distinction, like Terence McKenna, stay away from the chemicals and stick with the plants. But even the use of plants is a technology, knowing how to use them, technos, technique, and so forth.
Yeah, well, when you look at ketamine, it seems to have, for example, a profoundly different experience compared to a more true psychedelic in my mind. Still a useful tool, but maybe not leading to the same spiritual, connected to the universe feelings that some of
Yeah,
the
I mean,
others bring.
ketamine is only challenging in the sense that you might panic at being dead, that there's a thin boundary between a really high dose ketamine experience and deciding that there's no distinction between being alive and being dead. And that may cause a panic. But ketamine generally does not offer psychologically challenging experiences. It takes you all the way out. I kind of like that. I mean, I like drugs. I've had enough psychologically challenging experiences. I like drugs that take you all the way out. In a sense, DMT does too. Actually, heroin does that as well. It's drugs that take you away, definitely have something to offer. Not that I'm recommending heroin.
Fair enough.
Dextromethorphan would be another one that takes you all the way out.
Yeah, some you might describe that as that circuit eight out of body, out of mind experience. So I guess circling back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier around the singularity, if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like that the singularity is already here, or at least certain aspects of it.
Yeah, a version of the singularity is here. The idea that we can't know who we are, how we're situated within the new environment, the environment that we spend a lot of time on, and that is impacted by virtual space and the fact that over a billion people have been moved online, in which they are subjected to too many options, too many wild variations of reality and unreality, and lies and disinfo. I mean, we all brought our ignorances and our prejudices and so forth with us into this place. And when people talk about the dystopia that seems to have emerged in the digitization, the virtualization, the bringing online of everybody, they usually talk about the dastardly profit seekers. And they're partially responsible for it, but also the billions of people who came online came with their own ignorances and prejudices and toxic memes as well. And I mean, that's part of the poisonous pot that's being stirred up. You know, people talk about how Facebook resulted in genocidal attacks against, I can't remember the country, but people can look it up. But those angers and prejudices and feelings pre-existed Facebook.
Yes, thank you for that.
And I mean, of course, 20th century, people talk about the horrors being inflicted, but you know, 20th century had Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot. You know, we still haven't seen anything quite like that, I think, in the 21st century. And definitely some extreme horrors being inflicted right now in Gaza, but we haven't quite seen something on the scale of Stalin or Hitler in the 21st century, and let's hope we don't.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. And I think when we talk about the mental health of the young folk today and things like that, it, as it relates to social media, I would agree. I think what you were saying, what I would say is that this social media has really drawn out the worst of us. It's sort of shining a light in the dark closet of our mind, and maybe it's too much too fast and we're struggling to deal with it, but there it is.
I had the slogan that Sartre said, hell is other people, and I say hell is other people's tweets. And you know, people talked about bringing us together in the global brain, John Perry Barlow, and different people thought, oh, this is going to be great. We'll bring everybody together in the global brain. And what is happening is that familiarity breeds contempt, and we don't really like each other. We don't like the contents of other people's minds. And that's particular to people who are loud, right? I mean, there are people who want to impose the contents of their minds on other people. And I mean, there's a range of this from the somewhat sympathetic self-righteousness of people who, that some people call cancel culture, which is somewhat more benign than the absolutely intentional cruelty that eventually came out of institutions like 4chan and 8chan. People who just want to be cruel just for the heck of it, particularly if you're a woman or of a different color, etc. But I mean, there's a range of people who love the opportunity to get on here and just be nasty and mean at various levels. And that kind of makes us all feel bad about everybody, whereas plenty of people are probably out there being very nice and reasonable and kind and presenting, reasonable opinions and fair opinions, or even sincerely saying crazy things because that's what they believe, but that they shouldn't necessarily be shunned if they're reasonably nice people conducting themselves well.
I know I have to check myself online, and I've gotten to the point where I minimize Facebook because it seems to draw out the worst in me.
Yeah, Facebook is rough. Excuse me, I'm getting a paper towel. Yeah, nope. Facebook, I definitely have minimized the amount of posting I do there because people will argue about anything. I was like telling a friend I could post a picture of my foot and say, this is a foot. And
no, it's not.
The libertarians and the leftists would start arguing about it or something along those lines.
Well, it's fascinating to me. I guess I've always thought Leary was way ahead of his time, but actually it seemed like Marshall McLuhan predicted all this years ago, and he predicted it based on the telegraph as the kind of the turning point for the electronic digital age, and felt that the global village, or this transition into a global village, was going to be tremendously painful.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah. I mean, the counterculture embraced McLuhanism as a positive. We're going to have a global village. Isn't that great? But McLuhan warned that it was going to bring about, I think the word he used was conflict at every point. It's going to emphasize conflict and confusion. It's interesting to go back and revisit McLuhan and how lacking he was in optimism about the global village.
Did it seem Leary and Wilson both seem to really emphasize optimism and hope? And I guess my question is, having known them personally, I know you knew Leary more so than Wilson, but were they like that all the time?
No, I mean, not really. Tim had an exuberant personality, which was usually, he was usually up for it. He liked having a lot of people around him, and he gave off, most of the time he gave off a good energy. But, I mean, by the time I knew him, he was way past trying to pretend to be a holy man. So if he was in a bad mood, he wasn't hesitant. If he was pissed off, he wasn't hesitant. If he thought somebody needed to to hear a put down, there might be a put down in the offing. He could be mean. But most of the time, he was really upbeat. He was really encouraging to people. He was really enthusiastic about people when they came to him with their projects and stuff, to the point where he got mad at me because I thought this this woman had approached him about a video and asked him what he thought, and he was all effusive and this and that. And my sense was that he hadn't even actually looked at the video, which would not be that unusual for Tim. So I kind of made fun of that, and he really schooled me. He told me all about the video. He knew everything about it. He was authentic. I mean, that was the surprising thing about Tim that made his company enjoyable, was that you came to him expecting him to be a total trickster and a bit of a huckster, and you were always surprised by his authenticity. Most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time, he was really being genuine. He was being flip also. I mean, that was part of his personality. It's a great story William Gibson tells of hanging out with Tim, and somebody would come up to Tim and give him some drugs, and somebody else would come up to Tim, and Tim would give him the next person the drugs that the person had given to him, and Tim would say, "This is a win for two people. One person can say I gave Timothy Leary drugs, and the second person say Timothy Leary gave me drugs." And that was part of his personality too. Bob Wilson to me seemed more frequently depressed than Tim did. Bob had a rougher life financially. He didn't have these superstar earnings. I mean, Tim always spent all his money, but he could always do another tour and grab some more. And Bob, as we will read in the upcoming excellent biography of Leary by Kennedy, I'm forgetting his first name.
Gabriel.
Gabriel, yeah. Really wonderful book. I got to read a version of it early. But, I mean, Bob struggled a lot with poverty, not having enough money, and of course with physical problems and so forth. So Bob often seemed he had to fight harder to maintain his optimism, which I guess is why it pissed him off when I said, "Boy, how could he possibly be optimistic?" And he said, "Well, I couldn't walk when I was young, and I had to be optimistic in order to, I had polio, I had to be optimistic just to get on my feet and walk." And there's a great truth to that. I mean, I have to be optimistic to get up every day and try to remain alive. So I understand that. But neither of them were like 8th circuit yogic perfect, super humans. They were very, very, as Nietzsche said, human, all too human.
Right, that's what came to my mind, is just their humanity.
Yeah.
We've recently lost Antro Ali, and I don't know if what your relationship to him was, but I guess my bigger point is a question that keeps coming up is who holds the throne, but who do we look to these days with all these sort of counterculture people falling off to the wayside?
Yeah. Geez, I don't know. Don't look at me. I'm not sure what I'm not sure what even the message is to carry the news. I'm not sure what we can be pointing to. I mean, Doug Rushkoff is honest in his appraisal of what's going on. He works hard trying to figure out what's what. Eric Davis is honest in his appraisal of what's going on. He brings a marvelous sort of cosmic imagination to it all, but also has good reality-based politics and sense of humanity. Writers, these people are writers. Mark Darius started taking psychedelics. Who knows where that's going? A powerful cultural critic who had been very critical of Mondo 2000 in the 90s, but also wrote for us and has been a friend. So, I mean, there are a lot of writers to look at as far as how psychedelics unfold in our current global scenario or local scenario. I'm not sure who we should be looking to. I wouldn't look to people who are presenting extremely paranoid views of all these people like Leary and Huxley were awful because they had a version of eugenics that related to human evolution. And I mean I would pay attention, but I wouldn't pin my entire view of the world on the paranoid view of our psychedelic forefathers. It's a mixed bag, but I don't think there's anybody really out there to follow. I mean, maybe following is obsolete anyway.
Right.
I mean, there was Ram Dass. There was that whole thing. That's a peculiar world. Did Ram Dass actually do less? Everybody thinks of him as a genteel, good guy, but did he do less damage than Leary, or did he wind up leading people off to follow gurus, in which case they became parts of cults and ended up being subjected to a fair amount of abuse, whereas Leary kind of came out on the think for yourself and hey, maybe you're on your own, but let's try to be positive arena. So I find these contrasts interesting. I find that Leary loses with the public in contrast with a lot of people who might have actually been more harmful than he was, but Leary sort of had this sort of Hollywood slick persona, this presence that made people think, oh boy, this guy's a scoundrel. And, we all were. I have a term I like, that the counterculture of the 20th century was promoted by people who possessed rascalinity. These days, masculinity isn't to some extent in bad repute, and this other idea of rascalinity is perhaps something that we might miss as we move into a less gendered future. We might not miss it. I don't know. I make no predictions or claims in that area. But I will say that I do write some rascalinity-style lyrics occasionally and beg to be forgiven.
Well, one of the things you said early on in that discussion was maybe that, well, one, maybe it's not about following any particular person anymore. Think for yourself, as Leary might say. But that you're not even sure what message there would be to carry. which speaks to, I guess, back to the chaos we spoke of earlier. Is there any particular science fiction that appeals to you that maybe holds a candle of what to expect as we move forward here?
God, I don't know. There's some of the old Werner Vinge novels that seem to show us a post-singularity world. I can't remember the names of them right now. I don't know. I mean, we're Lost in Space, good title. That's pretty much where we are. I don't know. I'm watching The Three Body Problem right now on Netflix. Not that it that's I'm still trying to figure out whether it's really saying anything about the our current situation or not, but it certainly is a fascinating piece of science fiction. It was an excellent novel as well. I'm trying to remember. Nothing really. I mean, Philip K. Dick. I forgot the obvious. Pretty much, everything by Philip K. Dick reflects our world. And J.G. Ballard.
Ballard and
Everything by Ballard does a pretty nice job of reflecting our world in a very perverse way. I mean, particularly things like High Rise and Cocaine Nights, suburban freakouts on the verge of a downward spiral into ultraviolence. Not that not that there's any thing programmatic that it's offering to people, but that it's a pretty vivid reflection of where we are and where we're going. Burroughs, I mean, William Burroughs, his sort of broken brains, right? Broken texts, broken words, broken brains.
Interesting. Those are all writers that are that wrote decades ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, I mean the cyberpunk guys. I always look to Bruce Sterling in terms of what's going on now. Every year he does a discussion about the future on the Well that anybody can look at with John Lepkowski. So I always look to Bruce Sterling in terms of what's occurring right now, in terms of the depredations of what the online world of current virtual reality and virtual capitalism. I look to Cory Doctorow, who coined the term "enshittification." I look to his analysis of what's going on. I highly recommend everything by him. I can't claim to read his many of his novels recently. They tend to be in the sort of didactic area, but then again, so did a lot of Bob's stuff as well. But those are really good reflections of where we are now, I think. So that would be. I'm glad I remembered Cory Doctorow. That's good stuff to read in terms of trying to get a bead on what's going on now. I hope Sterling gets back into writing some science fiction.
Yeah, I have to confess I'm not terribly familiar with Doctorow's work. I know who he is, but I've not read a lot of
Yeah.
what he has to say.
Down and In the Magic Kingdom was a great one back much earlier in this century. People should grab his novels for sure.
And early on, you mentioned Leary's Future History series, which I forget
Yeah.
what composes that body of work specifically.
Okay, so let's see. There's Neuropolitics, Exopsychology. I think What Does Woman Want was actually first. The Game of Life and the Intelligence Agents. I would say, read all five of them as science fiction. And there's, any anybody who writes scripts for movies and TV shows, there's a lot of ideas in there that can be mined. The last one, the Intelligence Agents, is perhaps the most disturbing, but also the most fun of them all. Yeah.
I'm curious. It's been a while since I've read that one, but I'm curious what you found disturbing about it.
Know, traveling up the genetic highway, the West is superior to the East. I mean, there's plenty of eugenic speculation in there. But done with the great spirit in its own way, done in a very humorous way, and brilliant as considered as fiction, as clearly he was considering it as fiction, and even put other names on different segments. Like some of it was by Agnes Nin, and some of it was by Stuart Bland, and God, I can't remember all the Andy Warhol was credited with one of the pieces. Jane Fonda, but yeah, very entertaining and disturbing.
Yeah, well, I remember that the westward migration thing is a big theme in the work, and I didn't take that to be eugenical, I guess, but I also sit in a very privileged Western place when I read it, so where I didn't quite have the perspective necessary at that time.
I mean, on one level, it has a kind of sense to it, but I mean, it's very playful. I mean, it's about the spinning of the globe and how it's pushing people, and people are going with the spin and coming to the West. I mean, there's no pretense in that book that he's being reasonable. So it's very playful. So you have to allow for that.
There's certainly something about the discovery of what was largely untouched frontier of Northern America and Southern America, and how that created a lot of opportunity, unless you were a Native American, in which case maybe not so much.
I mean, Leary himself, I mean, in the post after Reagan got elected, he didn't go back and criticize his earlier stuff, but his comments became more anti-imperialist and more inclined towards acknowledging the importance of what people now call the Global South, and talked a lot about how it was ironic that southern vegetables, drugs from the South were colonizing Western minds as a kind of revenge of the colonized. Tim was question authority, right? So he was sent in one direction by the Jerry Brown, Jimmy Carter era to sort of challenge the liberalism, and then when Reagan came along, he kind of went off in the opposite direction, and was really a strong critic of Reaganism and the War Party, the Republican War Party, and the invasions of El Salvador and Nicaragua and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Tim was a unpredictable mixed bag politically, which is, I mean, that's where you end up without ideology. It can be it can be a good thing or it can be a messy thing. And it can, you can end up being extremely contradictory. Like, look at Bill Maher. I mean, he drifts. One minute he's in love with people who are revealing the secrets of the National Security Agency and the CIA, and the next minute he's hugging the deep state. I mean, MSNBC is another example of a lot of people who are doing that. And I mean, there are reasons for that, but there are also reasons to, I don't know, what can you say? Try to be a little smarter.
The most interesting theory I've seen on politics recently is, I guess what you'd call a technologist, Balaji Srivastava. He describes you have left and right, red and blue, and then he created a third, which he called the gray, which is the technologist, really. And I guess that resonates with me more so than left and right these days.
I think there's something beyond left and right, perhaps. But I do think right now, I mean, if we were living under Marxism-Leninism, then that would be the problem. But we're living under neoliberalism, and that's capitalism with oligarchy, with socialist aspects, with democratic aspects, with civil libertarian aspects, but mainly a fairly oligarchical system dominated by big capital. And I think that's where we have to keep our eye in terms of who is using power. And the neoliberalism has embraced many of the memeplexes of social activism. It uses correctness, which in turn makes people feel like the right-wing extremists and the Trumpists, nationalism of various kinds, is the opposition to the neoliberal center. So, and we have this imbalance where they're going back to embracing left and right for a moment. We're in a situation where we don't really have much of a left. We have neoliberalism and we have a right-wing nationalism challenging that. And you see that in the early days of anti-globalism was identified with a leftist and anarchist demonstrations, and you wanted Greece was looking at possibly seceding from the European Union, which because of the terrible terms that were being imposed on them by the World Bank and I can't remember the name of it now because it's been replaced by IDF, by the various banker groups. Many people who lean towards the left or even towards liberalism felt sympathetic towards towards Greece, and then suddenly it was England. That was one leaving the European Union, and everybody within liberalism and leftism was appalled that England would be leaving the neoliberal, gathering, just as everybody is appalled that Donald Trump suggests not being part of NATO. So, you have this dynamic where the only options seem to be a compromised neoliberalism that has always been lacking for bragging rights and is suffering an even greater loss of bragging rights right now in Gaza. And the only thing being contrasted with that globally is various forms of nationalism, a confused hodgepodge of nationalism, including Islamic countries and white racist groups and God knows what else. So, as Tim said, chaos, man. Yeah.
Chaos, man. Maybe that we can end there. What are you up to these days? Is there anything on your plate or?
There is a combination Mondo memoir / history that I wrote that was about to be released by a book company called Zero Books. Story of my life. There was a change of management. It had actually gotten exactly to the galley stage when there was a palace revolution at this left-wing book company, and new old people came in, and so the book was went into limbo. It was called and it's called The Freaks in the Machine, Mondo 2000 and Late 20th Century Tech Culture. It might be in the process of being reworked, possibly for MIT Press, but all that would just be rumor mongering. So that's going on. And mostly I'm engaged in recordings and having song lyrics that I wrote, getting those recorded. Mostly not doing my own vocals and getting other people to do them, but I invite people to come to my band camp. Look up Ken Goffman, Are You Serious? Band camp, and come on over. And it's actually mostly very, very like, I hate to say it, but it's like very slick professional sounding music. It's not just like a bunch of garage weirdos. Although some of it certainly has a garage weirdo charm as well. And there's some noise in there.
Okay.
Come on in.
Well, I will find that link and put it in the show notes as well as some of the other things we discussed today.
Yeah.
I hope your latest book makes it to fruition without. Yeah. Much further trouble. Sounds like it's been a ride.
Yeah.
Well, are you, Ken? Thank you for your time. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
That concludes the episode. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. A big thank you to RU for taking the time to chat. Thank you, as always, to Christina Pearson of the Robert Anton Wilson Trust and Richard Rasa of Hilaritas Press. The next episode will release as usual on the 23rd. Until then, I am your host, Mike Gathers, signing off with love and cheerfulness. Amor et Hilaritas. Hilaritas.